From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a ceasefire for Israel and Gaza forged in Egypt, maneuvers over the fiscal cliff, and Black Friday pushes into Thanksgiving Day. A rain of rockets, then an Israel-Gaza truce declared with the help of the U.S. and Egypt. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Cairo offered credit to Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi.
I want to thank President Morsi for his personal leadership to de-escalate the situation in Gaza and end the violence.
Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke spoke to the Economic Club of New York on Tuesday, warning Washington against running over the fiscal cliff.
In the worst case scenario, where the economy goes off the broad fiscal cliff, which according to CBO and to our own analysis would throw the economy into recession, I don't think the Fed has the tools to offset that.
And Black Friday hits Thursday. Stores opened on the Thanksgiving holiday. Early on Thanksgiving Day, tempers flared at an Indianapolis Kmart. Police came. A shopper described the Day of Thanks scene to WISH in Indianapolis.
Everybody started going crazy about it, and then cops got called in, and it was just became a madhouse.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Ben Smith of BuzzFeed, Alan Pizzi of CBS News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. What just happened in the Middle East? Will we dodge the fiscal cliff? Did you shop on Thanksgiving? Is nothing sacred? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us this week from New York is Ben Smith, editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed. Ben, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
With us from Tel Aviv in Israel is Alan Pizzi of CBS News. Alan Pizzi, thank you very much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
A little delay there. We'll work with that. And with me in the studio, fresh from no shopping on Thanksgiving Day, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ben, and Alan.
Alan Pizzi, let us come first to you. Is it really over? If it is, might it resume? Or do you think this heavy bout of rockets and missiles and conflict is behind us, Alan?
I think it's probably over for the time being, but no one here thinks that this is the be-all and end-all, that this is going to be the ceasefire that leads to a longer truce that leads to peace. I think we're just waiting for enough violations to call it a breakdown. That said, it should last for a little while if nobody does anything silly, because the Israelis are now heading into an election campaign. The voting takes place towards the end of January, and no politician wants to be in the middle of a war when he's in the middle of an election campaign. And Hamas has everything to gain by keeping it quiet for a while. The question is, can they keep Islamic Jihad and some of the other more radical groups in Gaza in line to the point where the Israelis will think that they're cooperating? And you know, this is solving this would take, I think, the wisdom of Solomon and the patience of Job. The only good thing is that they're both prophets in the Quran and the Torah. But apart from that, I don't see a lot of hope of this leading. Something will happen. Something always goes wrong. History's on the wrong side, I think.
Alan Pizzi, who do you give credit for this whole thing getting to the ceasefire? Whose handiwork is that?
I think a lot of credit has to go to President Mohamed Morsi of Egypt, because he was the one who could talk to Hamas. He's the one who could put a fair amount of squeeze on Hamas, because their one exit, their one exit point for anybody they wanted to get out of, than any entry point for weapons. It comes down to the tunnels at Rafah. And he had a lot of influence with them. They also could talk to him and trust him because their roots are in the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think the Israelis were probably listening, if not listening to the Americans, just realizing the Americans knew what they wanted them to do, and the Israelis had to listen to a certain point because there's an awful lot of money comes in here. And I think that the Americans, in the form of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, stepped in at just about the right time to put the imprimatur of the big power on it, and everything came together. I don't, equally, it has to be said that a large percentage, like something like 70% of Israelis did not want a ground war. So there are a lot of factors coming together, but I think it was Morsi and Clinton that did it.
Ben Smith, in New York, what do you think we've seen and learned in this week of fighting and then negotiation and then ceasefire, Ben?
Well, I mean, one thing I think we've learned is how difficult it is for the U.S. administration to, as Obama, you know, was very deliberately trying to do this week, pivot away from the Middle East, or very ostentatiously put the attention of the second term on the relationship with Asia, only to have to dispatch Hillary Clinton back to deal with another sort of incomprehensible, very difficult to resolve flare-up in Gaza?
Yes, it's hard to get away from it. I mean, Jack, here's the sound even now. This was, I think we heard a little at the top of the hour maybe, but a 20-year-old reported killed, 9 others wounded. This was a clash with Israeli soldiers right on the border of Gaza today. In response, Palestinians were demonstrating here at the border fence. Israeli security fired tear gas. This is within the ceasefire. How about you, Jack? What do you see here? What have we learned in the fight, in the negotiation, in the ceasefire?
What I'm struck with, and what the reporting has brought out, and maybe Alan can expand on it, is the diminished role of Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority, that Hamas has stolen the, while not popular within Gaza, is appealing in the West Bank precisely because they are standing up to Israel, and that there is a cleavage between how the United States government views Mr. Abbas. We think he's a partner for peace. We think he can do business. And how the Israelis view him. They don't see him that way at all. They don't want to give him an inch because they don't think he can deliver. And so far as that remains so, you'd think one, quote, tentative solution might be to make life in the West Bank so good for the Palestinians and their own little statelet there that it would drain the radicalism from Hamas. And you'd feel, well, people there would say, gee whiz, if we only recognize Israel, we can live the way those folks are. But the Israelis won't take that first step for all sorts of obvious reasons. And this week underlines one of them. Rockets. I mean, how are they going to get any guarantee of that? So it looks like an insoluble situation. But right there, this man who looks like he could make some kind of wider peace, his role weakened.
Alan Pizzi, what about it? Mahmoud Abbas with Fatah, the one-time partner for peace. He can look very much diminished this week. Why is that? What's led to that, Alan?
I think what's led to that is that Abbas sat back and hasn't really done anything from the Israelis. He hasn't managed to improve the plight of the Palestinians that much. He's seen as ineffectual. Hamas, on the other hand, did what they all like to do, which is stand up to Israel. And we're seeing it as being a bit, having won another victory, albeit a somewhat pyrrhic one, but there was still a victory in the eyes of the Palestinians. And then Hamas ends up center stage almost, being courted by the United States by way of the Egyptians, and the Israelis having to go through the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas has Muslim Brotherhood roots, and that makes them look even stronger. It gives them the cachet of being, we're the guys who made them come to the table. We're the guys who made them talk. And it's interesting that there were demonstrations in Hebron and Ramallah in favor of Hamas. Now, you'd expect it in Hebron because that's
in the West Bank, yeah.
Hamas enclave on the West Bank, in the West Bank. But Ramallah is very much Fatah territory, and they're coming out. It's kind of a slap in the face for Abbas, and it tells the Israelis, whoa, maybe we should have talked to that guy, because now the man they have to go to is not the man they want to talk to. If Hamas could get rid of its constant rhetoric of destroying the state of Israel, which is, if you think about it, totally impossible, but if they could get past that, they would really be in what the British call the pound seats, I think.
But who, Ben Smith, who do you think ends up in better position after all this? Israel says, look, we've taken out a lot of these longer-range rockets. I mean, they've flattened, a half dozen or more major Palestinian government buildings, lots of destruction, sort of a punishment, a message to Hamas, the price of all those rockets. On the other hand, Hamas is having victory celebrations and saying we're more in tune with the new Arab Spring era and the populace of many Arab countries in this era. History's coming our way. Who do you think's got the momentum or the better position out of this, Ben?
Well, I think they view it so differently. From the Israeli, I think this Israeli government doesn't really see an end game. I think this is, for them, they refer to it as cutting the grass in terms of, suppressing,
pushing back the threat,
assuming it'll grow back, right? Mm-hmm. They see it really as this kind of state of essentially permanent, low-grade war with these guys, and don't really see, I think momentum isn't really part of that conversation. I don't think they really see this as a step toward a next stage of this conflict. I think they see this as a status quo that's going to continue indefinitely. Whereas, I think Hamas was looking to test a totally new regional environment, which they did. I think one of the very interesting things that happened, right, is that the Egyptian president yesterday abruptly took on what he says are very sweeping temporary powers to go around the judiciary, which, you know, I'm not sure whether it's a direct result of the stature that he gained in Gaza, but it seems related.
Maybe cutting the grass, Jack, but bigger rockets, more rockets they found this time, and still, and Gaza still under the Israeli embargo, still a tough life there.
A very tough life. A listener sent us in a United Nations report on life, 5 years of blockade, summing up the humanitarian situation. Now, this is from the UN, and it's just a desperate situation. The water is barely drinkable. The sewage issues are terrible, poisoning the environment. The unemployment approaches 50%. It's one of the youngest populations in the world. And there's some forecast here that by 2020, the strip will basically be unlivable. It won't have water. It won't have the basic necessities of even a suboptimum life. That seems to be the situation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a big week in the news this holiday week. Missiles and ceasefire over Gaza, Egypt, center stage there, the president to Asia and back, and lots of fiscal cliff maneuvering. Alan Pizzi with CBS News joins us from Tel Aviv in Israel today. Ben Smith of BuzzFeed, editor-in-chief there, joins us from New York. And our own news analyst Jack Beatty is with us in the studio. I want to look at what's going on in Egypt. Caller two on the ceasefire. Westboro, Massachusetts, Imran is calling. Imran, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, I just find the whole, this whole scenario really very cynical because if the New York Times is to be believed in its reporting, you know, this whole skirmish has been manufactured really to try to test out the capabilities of Israel's anti-defense system, Iron Dome. And at least the way it was explained in the press was that it's a way of looking at Iran's capability to send missiles over and Iron Dome's ability to kind of fight against it.
Yep.
And the cost of this, I mean, to the American taxpayer, they were citing in the paper that it's like $275 million is being, you know, sent to Israel to support missile defense. So I just find that this whole thing is really almost manufactured to provoke, you know, people who really are throwing missiles that are a little more than rockets with not much in the way of a warhead, and just missing their targets, and then they are using their anti-missile system to see how well they can deter it. And it just strikes me as not Israel not really being interested in trying to reach a peace accord with Abbas, because if there was peace, you know, it'd be harder to try to provoke these things.
No, we haven't seen much on the peace front. That is certainly true. But do you dismiss the rockets coming out of Gaza too easily? I mean, if you live in one of those towns, they come in. Some of them are pretty big now. I mean, big. And some of them reach, we saw Tel Aviv this time. That's hard, I suppose, Iran, to live with, no?
Of course it's hard to live with. And, you know, I would rather not see anything get sent over each other's borders. But to put it in perspective, if you can believe the press, I mean,
yep,
the rockets that come over from Hamas cost about $800 to make. They're very cheap. They're not very sophisticated. They miss half their targets. And, Iron Dome, I think, cost something like $50 million.
For each of those installments, they've got four now. They're looking for more. They're looking and have already had U.S. help in that. Imran, thanks for that. Alan Pizzi, what about this whole week of conflict as the Times was reporting as a kind of trial run for potential conflict with Iran, in which case Israel might have to face rockets from Hezbollah, from out of Lebanon, from Hamas perhaps, from elsewhere, from Iran itself. What about this as a military trial run? Does that sound credible to you, Alan?
Simply by the fact that it's cynical, it does sound credible, actually. I don't know that they were actually want to provoke a shooting war and lose their citizens just for that, but I can see that might be an interesting aspect for them of this whole conflict. And, you know, The rockets are getting better. The Fajr 5, which the Iranians proudly said they gave to Islamic Jihad, they would have reached Tel Aviv if they'd been on target, or a couple of others would have reached if they hadn't been shot down. So there's a genuine concern on the part of the Israelis about this sort of thing. You know, bear in mind, too, that the Israelis say that about 1,000 tons of high explosives were fired into Israel, and 1,000 times that was, it was 1,000 times more tonnage was dropped on Gaza than was fired into Israel. So the Israelis are they're not outgunned by any stretch of the imagination, and I think that they do want to whip up. They kept bringing Iran back into this when Hillary Clinton was here. Iran came up, and Benjamin Netanyahu brought up. That's their big bogeyman, and they want everybody to focus on that. Whether they were practicing. I'm sure they enjoyed the practice. They were pleased to have it. Whether they provoked it's another matter. I wouldn't want to go that far.
Mary in Newton, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to say that one thing on the study about how in Gaza their economy is so bad. Well, when the Israelis left, they left greenhouses. They left lots of other structures open and other ways that they could have gained and helped with their economy. Instead, they destroyed it all because they are centered on hate. They celebrate, they give out candy when they kill Israeli children. They have been raining down terrible missiles, not just $800 ones. The pregnant woman was killed in Israel. That's not necessarily reported. And basically, even when the missiles miss, people can't take showers alone because they have to be afraid because they have 15 seconds to run into their
shelter.
Even when they don't hit, their entire lives are being destroyed because people are attacking. If people were sending missiles into America, we would carpet bomb. Israel does not carpet bomb. It does not do what other nations would do. And as a result, the missiles keep coming. We can't forget the fact that Hamas does not believe that they have a right to exist. And as a result, this is not just a mutual little war here. This is people who want to destroy a nation attacking and another nation trying very, very hard by sending out leaflets warning of impending attacks, not to kill people. Israelis are not happy when Palestinian children are killed because of collateral damage. Palestinians are aiming to kill Israeli children. This is a very, very different
thing. Mary, we've got it loud and clear. Let me get one more. We'll look at both. Teddy in New Haven, Connecticut. Teddy, you're on.
I really think we need to back off and look at the fact that the Israelis have been anxious to have reasons to destroy the Palestinian communities in Gaza. They have set up illegal communities everywhere, and they are using anything as an excuse. I believe the gentleman who said that he was perhaps cynical was, in fact, perhaps realistic.
But what do you mean, Teddy, using anything? I mean, the rockets have come out of Gaza. Of course, a lot more have gone in. Many more people died in Gaza.
Exactly.
But still, those were rockets coming out of Gaza. That wasn't a figment.
And before there were rockets, there were bulldozers knocking down people's houses. We have assisted the Israelis in creating a war in a place where children grow up knowing they are endangered. If we raised children the way the Palestinians have to raise their children in terrible camps and in terrible conditions, and in knowing they would like that there are people surrounding you who would like to destroy you and take your land when it should be shared land, is an awful way to think you're going to get peaceful people to come to a table.
Teddy, we've got it. I think I'm just going to let Mary and Teddy's observations stand side by side there. I mean, that is that kind of eternal conflict. It is costly on all fronts, and we saw it in life and in property and in fear again this week. Now, the ceasefire came out of Egypt, and Morsi was very big in that, but at the same time, practically, Alan Pizzi, you're in the region, he's grabbing big new power for himself on this side of the revolution against the revolt against Mubarak. Here's a little tape from Thursday, a news conference in Cairo. Sameh Ashour, head of the Egyptian Lawyers Syndicate, attacking the Egyptian President Morsi for granting himself all these new, huge, sweeping powers this week.
We ask for the following: bring down this constitutional proclamation and dissolve the Constituent Assembly because it has lost its legitimacy. And we call for a national dialogue to agree on a new mechanism to bring together all the forces and other factions in the country to stop the Islamic wing from taking over.
Alan Pizzi, is that what we're seeing here? Some suspicion that Mohamed Morsi, head of the Islamic Brotherhood, wants to draw up a new constitution for Egypt on this side of Mubarak that would be very friendly to the Islamic Brotherhood, a kind of Islamist state. Does that sound exaggerated to you? Does that sound realistic to you?
It sounds like what he's probably trying to do, although I think Morsi is more of a moderate than people give him credit for. Moderate in our terms, but his powers, he claims that those powers will only last until there is a new constitution and a referendum on it, and then elections for a legislative assembly. So he's saying, I'm only doing this for a while to ensure the smooth transition. Egyptians obviously don't believe him, and I think probably the international community will take it with a grain of salt as well. Whether or not he's trying to become the new Mubarak, having seen Mubarak toppled, I doubt that only having come in with a very slim majority, I don't think he's likely to try to go the Mubarak route, but he'll certainly try to push things his way.
Let me bring it halfway home to U.S. U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice, of course, who next door we've got Libya, the whole debate over Benghazi, her early comments on those. Senator John McCain, Lindsey Graham made much of those. President Obama standing up in his press conference last week, sort of standing by his diplomat there. Here was Susan Rice on Wednesday talking about the comments that she made, those several on Sunday shows before the presidential election about the Benghazi attacks.
I relied solely and squarely on the information provided to me by the intelligence community. I made clear that the information was preliminary and that our investigations would give us the definitive answers.
Ben Smith, Hillary Clinton, right in the middle of all the negotiation over ceasefire this week, but by all expectations, she's headed out as Secretary of State. President Obama will have to nominate somebody new. Does it look to you as though he may put Susan Rice up as his candidate in spite of the heavy Republican flak on this front?
Yeah, every indication is that he will. I mean, I think they had an opportunity. They had sort of hinted that it would be her. She came under this fire, and there was sort of the opportunity to let that trial balloon go, and they have not. I mean, I think, you know, it's funny. She's being criticized for this briefing she gave where nobody really thinks that she was the one writing the talking points, or that she was the one gathering the intelligence. I mean, she's the UN ambassador. It wasn't something coming directly to her. She was, I think, reading these talking points that came from the CIA, that the director of national intelligence allegedly was the one who took out the stuff the Republicans are upset about having been omitted. But she's become kind of the for at least for John McCain and for Lindsey Graham, she's sort of the face of what they see as some sort of cover-up. I mean, it's funny because there are lots of other. The criticism of her to this point had not been that she was slippery or dishonest, but that she was too blunt to be a diplomat. And that's been sort of the running criticism of her. So this is a bit sort of the reverse of that.
Jack, how do you read this one? There's Susan Rice. You could look at what she said. You could certainly listen that day, and it could sound political in advance of a presidential election with a very unfortunate situation on the administration's hands. On the other hand, some of the criticism has sounded kind of over the top. You're the president. What do you do here? Stick with Susan Rice? We don't even know if she was his number one candidate in the first place, but now they kind of got arms around one another here.
Yes, it's become a test of his prestige, I think. And for the Republicans, rather a sticky wicket. Joe Scarborough, who is the host of Morning Joe and a well-connected Republican, says people he's talking to in the party want this to go away. They want McCain and Graham to stand down because, quote, the optics are so bad. After an election in which, you know, young women especially voted overwhelmingly for Obama
and
people
minorities
of color
the
voted
same.
Overwhelmingly mm-hmm. here, there, beating up on a relatively young woman of color. And they just say, the Republicans he talked to say, let's not make this the fight. Let's not go on about this. And there's a complication here. Harry Reid may change the Senate rules such that a senator who, if you want to put on a filibuster, McCain has at least, there's been some talk about that, filibustering her mm-hmm. nomination, he would have to, and Graham and others, stand on the floor and talk about
hour after hour,
hour after
about
hour.
They could just read the phone book,
Jack. They could read the phone book, but it could be a very awkward situation for them as well.
Alan Pizzi, American secretaries of state have a lot to do with the way Middle East negotiations at least tend to go. From your seat, from your vantage, does it matter if it's Susan Rice or somebody else?
I don't think it matters who the person is, as long as they can do the job and they come with the prestige of the United States government, the imprimatur of the president. I think that there are certainly different people can handle different situations better than others, but I think by and large, if an American Secretary of State drops in on a peace process like this one, it doesn't really matter whether it's Susan Rice or Hillary Clinton or anybody else you'd like to name. It is the Secretary of State and not the person who's coming. It's the representative of the U.S. government who's coming. So I don't think that part of it matters. Certainly, the way you handle people does. Everybody says that Hillary Clinton gets very high marks, for example, for the way that she knows how to deal with these people. Because dealing with, say, Benjamin Netanyahu is a lot different than dealing with Mohammed Morsi. Netanyahu is a hard case. And there are other people that they think in a different way, and you can't get through to them. So I think the Secretary of State's job now requires you to be a very skillful diplomat. Somebody said being in the art of diplomacy is telling somebody to go to hell in such a way as they'll look forward to the trip. And yeah. you really need that skill. But at the end of the day, when all the work is done and it just needs a stamp of approval, it doesn't matter who it is as long as they represent the United States government.
Let's go to Janet in Auburn, Alabama. Janet, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom and all. Hi. I was just wondering, as far as Secretary of State, I've had this thought for a week or two. Has any thought been given to John Huntsman at all? It seems he has expertise in Asia. It would really be going across the aisle, but he's been with Barack Obama before. I'm a progressive, by the way, very much so.
Okay.
But I just think that maybe, I don't know much about Susan Rice, but I just wonder if anybody knows if there's been any thought on anybody's part towards John Huntsman as far as Secretary of State.
Let us pick it up. Yeah, we've got it. A little healing there, maybe. Across the aisle move. Ben Smith, of course, he was former ambassador to China. It would be a Republican drawn in to Obama's administration. On the other hand, how much credit would he get? He barely made it. He didn't make it out of the primaries, to the final rounds. Have you heard anything on that front, Ben?
Yeah, the great mentioner did at some point mention him. There was like a little wave of chatter, and there is a logic to it. I mean, it's the sort of thing Obama likes to do, right? I mean, there was Hillary Clinton, his current Secretary of State, was also, you know, his unimaginable
great rival.
He would appoint his enemy to that job.
Yep.
Huntsman ran a terrible campaign in which he really kind of diminished himself, essentially. He also attacked it, you know, when not attacking Obama didn't work, he tried attacking Obama for a while during that campaign. And I think there's a lot of eye-rolling about him in the White House at this point, so I don't think I think that is unlikely, even though there is kind of a superficial charm to it.
But, Jack, it's a moment when some kind of gesture of breaking out of the box might deliver on Barack Obama's old promise of hope and change the way things work in Washington, at a time when maybe on other fronts, and we'll come to the fiscal cliff right after this break, but he may hold cards there. Maybe he can afford to be big one way or another.
This might be one way to do it. Equally, there's been some talk about Chuck Hagel, the former senator from Nebraska, Republican, for Secretary of Defense. That, too, would be a gesture. These, of course, are not totems of the conservative movement, Huntsman, but nevertheless, they're Republicans and they have stature.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news, this Thanksgiving week, 2 dead and 80 injured in a massive highway pileup on a foggy Texas interstate east of Houston on Thanksgiving Day. Yesterday, over 100 cars in the crunch as they piled up one after another. This driver was there.
We just heard car after car. Boom, 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 boom.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie came in from Hurricane Sandy relief for a cameo on Saturday Night Live.
I'd like to thank the Red Cross and first responders. I'd also like to give a special thanks to my lovely wife, Mary Pat Christie, who's here tonight, who put up with a husband who has smelled like a wet fleece for the past 3 weeks.
He was out there. A lot of Republicans still grumbling about Chris Christie and all that. And the big baker, Hostess Brands, got permission to liquidate, spelling the end for thousands of jobs. But the iconic Twinkie brand will go on the auction block and may well survive. Here's an old ad from Twinkie's Better Days.
Snacks like Hostess Twinkies. They help your child go and grow. Hostess Twinkies give your child energy to go on, plus protein to grow on.
Woohoo! Protein, no less than that. Magic, the magic of Twinkies. They'll go and grow. Ben Smith is with us, editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed from New York. Alan Pizzi of CBS News joins us today from Tel Aviv. Jack Beatty is with us in the studio. Lots of talk about the fiscal future this week. In the fiscal cliff here on Monday, this was Republican Tom Price of Georgia telling CNN that raising taxes would be a fool's errand if it was not accompanied by big spending reductions.
Tax increases to chase ever higher spending is a fool's errand. What we need to do is have that balanced approach that we've all been talking about, which again is increasing revenues through a process of tax reform and then spending reductions.
Well, and here's an interview of Nancy Pelosi telling ABC News' Martha Raddatz that a deal to avert the upcoming fiscal cliff would need to include tax rate increases on higher income earners. Anything else, she said, would be unacceptable. You'll hear Martha Raddatz's question first.
We've seen talk about a possible compromise that would leave rates the same but cap deductions for high income earners. Is that something that's acceptable?
No.
Not at all. No way.
Well, no. I mean, the president made it very clear in his campaign that there are not enough resources. What you just described is a formula and a blueprint for hampering our future.
Okay, fiscal cliff. Ben Smith, do you see progress towards some kind of agreement? There was that meeting at the White House, less than a week ago now. Boehner, Mitch McConnell, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, the president, they were pretty polite coming out of there. But what about the maneuvering here? Ben, is it headed toward an answer or over the cliff we go?
My impression, and I think a lot of people's impression, is that this very quickly moved from the this could actually go over the cliff phase to a kind of kabuki theater, where Boehner signaled early on that he was ready and willing to deal, where Obama and Boehner had both come very close to the kind of deal or the shape of deal, you know, 2 years ago now that could kind of be the groundwork for this one. And there's also been talk of doing a down payment now, resolving some of the deficit now, and then kicking some of it into next year. The sticking point is that Republicans have all signed this pledge to never to raise taxes. Barack Obama would like nothing better than to force them to break it and to put them all in a, you know, politically difficult position. While Boehner is looking for a way to raise revenues without technically increasing tax rates by closing what they will call loopholes, although loophole is the kind of loose word that you can apply to basically anything.
But he wants to put them in a politically difficult position now. Why exactly? He just won re-election to the White House. It's 4 years before that's up for grabs again. Two to the next congressional elections. I mean, wouldn't the interest of the country come before political advantage at a moment like this?
Well, I think the idea of kind of breaking the no tax hike pledge is very appealing to Democrats. I think Obama also came in 4 years ago saying things like what you just said and has basically learned his lesson and will be looking to the midterm elections immediately with the, you know, kind of distant hope that the Democrats could retake the House, but certainly with the hopes of protecting the Senate majority and the seats they have in the House. And I think that, like, the idea... I think he learned his lesson about not being very calculating about the midterm elections in 2008 and won't repeat that.
Jack, we heard, there's debate over the cliff itself and how serious is this? Could we just roll over it? It would be fine, thank you. But you heard Ben Bernanke, top of the show, saying, A, if we go broadly over it, we've got a recession coming. And B, that the Fed would not be able to do much about it. And they have done a lot to minimize recession in the last 2 or 3 years. So where are we headed? Where do we stand?
Well, that is a if simply the prospect of going over the cliff could itself be damaging to the economy. It's already being damaging, according to many studies. You know, I mean, the key question is how far are the Republicans willing to move toward the Democrats on revenue and how far are the Democrats willing to move to the Republicans on entitlements? And for each individual Republican and Democrat, there are serious stakes. For example, Saxby Chandless, a Republican senator from Georgia, who's been making, he's one of the gangs of six or eight or or whatever it is who've been talking about, you know, some bipartisan solution, perhaps an increase in taxes and so on. Well, the fellow you just quoted from, Tom Price, a representative from Georgia, is fixing to run against Mr. Chambliss if he does go in the direction of taxes on that basis. So is another congressman down there. He's vulnerable. On the Democratic side, if the Republicans say we want to change, you know, President Obama actually in 2011 came out for raising, I think by 2 years, the eligibility for Medicare. That's a serious matter. And if he's talking about changing the benefit formula for Social Security such that it would be pegged to inflation rather than other measures, that means a reduction in benefits. What does that mean? Well, you know, Paul Krugman and other liberals have been pointing out, yes, life expectancy is longer for people in the upper income groups.
The ones who don't need Social Security as much.
Yes, I've checked the data. I mean, if for men born in 1941, people in the lower half of the wage distribution live on average 6 years less than people in the top 50%. This is life and death for working people. They voted for Obama overwhelmingly, people of low income.
Yeah.
He can't sell them down the river. But on the other hand, the Republicans are going to want him to go as far in that direction as possible. It's a real issue here. I mean, if Obama wants the Republicans to break their tax pledge, they sure want him to break pledges on entitlement.
And when that inequality gap opens up, not just in income or wealth, but in time on this earth.
On the earth.
You've got something big going on. Ethan in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Ethan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I guess one of the questions that I have for our guest is there perhaps a deep-seated psychological fear of breaking the status quo? And that can come from both sides of the aisle in this issue of the fiscal cliff. Is that possibly playing a role in some of these negotiations and standoffs that we've seen over the past 2 years?
Well, that's interesting. Alan Pizzi could speak to fears of breaking the status quo in the Middle East. You may have some kind of that dynamic there. But Jack, what bring it home? I mean, on the one hand, you know, changing big things is hard. People are afraid to do it. On the other hand, this time we're told you've got to make some changes here because the status quo is going to break one way or the other. Now, I don't know if that's true, but what about the psychological question of just getting out of where we've been because we've been there?
Well, the economists call it path dependency. What you did yesterday, you'll do tomorrow.
Yeah.
And the parties have been locked into this, partly because of the no tax pledge on the Republican side, partly because of the Democrats' unwillingness to budge on entitlement. Something you would think would have to give. This might be the moment. The thought of hanging wonderfully concentrates the mind. But as Ben was indicating, there may be a fudge here. Both parties may agree to sort of fudge.
What would that look like?
Well, that might agree, you know, some sort of scaffolding for an agreement to be reached
later.
But I thought
things happened on January 1st. Bush tax cuts come to an end, landscape reformed.
Anything can be done, I think, legislatively, if they want to. Now, whether Obama would agree to that or not, I don't know. His leverage is maximum right now. He's just won this election. In 3 months, in 6 months, he'll have less.
Do you feel some fluidity, Ben Smith, or is all this posturing out front of an actual real commitment to no change?
No, I think there's lots of fluidity. I don't think the congressional leaders like having single-digit approval ratings, and I think Obama's willing to compromise quite a bit in order to get past this, to get to what he sees as, you know, part of his legacy. So no, I mean, I think this is a moment when you have Boehner and Obama both looking to make a deal.
Carlos, Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks for calling, Carlos. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to speak with respect to the fiscal cliff.
Yes.
I believe that there's a sense, it's going on continuously, cynicism. And America is not stupid. These politicians treat us like we're stupid, like we don't know what's going on. What we do not have is a voice. We do not have a voice to address what they're doing, giving the kitchen sink the house away. You want to get serious about this problem? Address corporate loopholes. How is it that you can try to justify to America that GE pays no taxes and then manages to retrieve or obtain a tax refund. That's despicable, it's shameful, and disgraceful.
So Carlos saying, Jack, you know, don't take us for dopes out here. We're watching the whole picture, including that end of it.
Yes, and when people talk about tax reform, this is one of the issues raised, that, you know, people in the similar circumstances should pay the same rate, and you shouldn't have, just because someone can use a loophole, a corporation or an individual, they shouldn't be able to do that if they're being paid at the same rate or if their profit is the same as another company. There's even some talk, I see in today's Times, almost a recommendation from one of their economic writers, that the 1986 tax reform bill be sort of replayed with Bill Bradley as Secretary of the Treasury.
Meaning?
Well, he was one of the architects of that,
yep.
and he knows how to do that, and he has cred on that. And but the hope for it is something more equitable than what we have. But of course, equally, that's what lobbyists exist for, to prevent that. That's the status quo.
I mean, I don't know where we're headed. Ben Smith, we had John Boehner talking this week, speaking about things to be pulled onto the table. It wasn't corporate loopholes, as Carlos suggests out of Nashville. He said, we've got to bring Obamacare back into this fiscal cliff, fiscal negotiation. Is that serious, or is that just posing?
No, that's not serious. I think, kind of throwing a bone to the conservatives in his caucus, who would love to do that and kind of have a never-say-die approach to the fight against the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. But it's you know, that this is not a bill that you're going to get the president to sign.
Okay, so maybe it's not so far around the bend as we feared. I don't know who's paying attention. Maybe Americans are just out on Black Friday doing their thing, or Gray Thursday, whatever it was yesterday. Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Tom, I think it's unfair that many of us who really detest the idea of stores being open on Thanksgiving blame Walmart, our Target. I mean, these stores are merely trying to remain solvent and meet a tremendous demand that the American public has for inexpensive goods and services.
The defender of Walmart is at our door. Americans want to shop on Thursday and they need the business. Well, I don't know. Ben, were you out pulling in cheap televisions yesterday for the family holidays?
No, we skipped Black Friday, but I was too busy editing posts of horrifying pictures of Black Friday to actually make it out, and then being called elitist for doing that.
Well, okay. What did you see in those photographs, Ben?
You know, just long lines and mob scenes, and people. I mean, people don't look very happy. It doesn't. You know, it's not. It isn't. But I. You know, I do think people are getting some nice 50-inch TVs at some deep discounts.
I mean, our caller, Jack, says, look, you got to do business. You know, the customer is always right. The customer will line up on Thanksgiving, so it's right. On the other hand, you know, the urge to acquire is maybe limitless in human beings, and one of the ways that we step away from that historically is by just agreeing all among ourselves to put a couple of days a year off limits. I mean, what do you think about roaring away to shop on Thanksgiving and to work in the stores, because of course that's part of the equation.
That's the tough part, people actually having to work on this day. You know, I think it's a comment on, yes, low prices, but also this low economy. People, this means something to people to get some discounts ahead of Christmas. They can't pay full freight in this economy. And I take it as a comment on the wider trend toward inequality, where you low prices are the other side of low wages, but also the crisis situation many Americans are in. Just, if I'm going to get gifts, I can't spend what I did last year. I mean, it seems to me a kind of...
So shove away early from the family table, leave the in-laws, head for the Walmart. John in Nashville, Tennessee. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, real quick, the decisions made regarding the fiscal cliff, do you think they would be dramatically different had Mitt Romney been elected president?
Well, I mean, it's hard to bring the counterfactual to bear, but let's try it for a minute. Jack, let's say that Congress looked pretty much like it does, but it was President Romney instead of President Obama. Do you think we'd have a very different conversation here?
I just don't think so. I mean, I think that he would have postponed his big tax plan for the next year. And I do think the Republicans would have gone as far as they needed to go to get him through this. If that meant they had to fudge around, as the Times does today, with a formula that would have more affluent people, their rates wouldn't go up, but they would be paying more through changing formulae and so on down
but
below.
But avoiding the cliff so as not to put a recession right on Romney's doorstep.
I think they would have gone the extra mile for that, for him, in a way that I don't know that they're so apt to go for Mr.
Well, I saw pictures of Mitt Romney at Disneyland this week. And on his way to see the vampire movie. So that is a scenario. We will never know the answer to that. Ben Smith, the president back from Asia this week, kind of on China's, you know, lower backyard there in Southeast Asia. Is he achieving what he's setting out to in the pivot to Asia, Ben?
I mean, I think just by saying it and by spending time there, that certainly does go some way just to signaling the second term priorities. This was not, I don't think, it was symbolically very important for him to go to Burma. But beyond that, I'm not sure this had immediate payback. But I do think, you know, that this was a major statement for how they're looking at foreign policy for the next 4 years.
Historic visit there, the president with his nod to Burma, Myanmar, with his nod to the big Buddha there in Thailand, and China watching it all with interest. It's great, all three of you to be with us today. Alan Pizzi with CBS News in Tel Aviv. Thank you so much for coming on today, Alan. Great to have you.
It was a pleasure.
Ben Smith on this day after Thanksgiving. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, well, enjoy the rest of the holiday. Thanks for being here, Jack.
Thank you so much.
Same to you, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.